The following message is brought to you by Terry Moore. And now, Mr. Moore.
Thank you very much, Mr. Bradick, and good Sabbath to everyone. Today's message is going to be a little bit technical and perhaps a little bit more Bible study-like, but I think it's important to discuss in services. And today's message will probably be one of a few messages that I will give on the subject, because there is a growing theory among believers that is known as the young earth creationism. And while this belief actually dates back hundreds, possibly thousands of years, it lost much ground in the early to mid 1800s as the scientific community and the knowledge that was attained through science widened to include much more accurate methods of dating ancient and prehistoric artifacts. But at the start of the 20th century, there was a renewed interest in young earth creationism, and likely because of the theories of evolution, which I think is probably the prime reason many people came up with this other theory. But young earth creationism claims that the earth is geologically recent, and that the Great Flood actually laid down most of the geographical strata in the space of a single year, and that most of the continents and the lakes and the enormous landmarks that appear around the world, that these actually were not established over hundreds of thousands of years, but only took place roughly 4,000 years ago after the great flood that Noah and his family experienced began to recede. So young earth creationism actually has significant difficulties with the scriptures. And while believing in a young earth or not, it's not a matter of salvation, but it can cause problems when attempting to understand or perhaps to explain the plan of humanity, God's plan, that is, for humanity. So I'd like to do this message today, which is going to be one of probably two, maybe three, hopefully not, might get bored of the subject. But this is going to be regarding this theory of young earth creationism and also the concept of recreation, as widely taught by the Church of God and as many of us are already familiar with. And the reason I found it appropriate to talk about this subject today is because young earth creationism is beginning to take hold among some in God's church. And it's important, I think, therefore, to review the evidence that we have at the time scientifically, also the review the evidence that we have from the scriptures that teaches us something different, and to consider, therefore, the thoughts and the theories of what are actually well-intended individuals that are propagating the idea of young earth creationism when they themselves only have a partial understanding of God's plan for humanity and therefore the scriptures in general. So we need to keep our people on track. And I'm not saying that those young earth creationists are bad people. They're actually, most of them are really decent folk. But we need to make sure that we're on track with the scriptures and not with theories. And so I've spent many hours reviewing their evidence, re-examining our own evidence of recreation, and I've put together a list of the biggest arguments on both sides. And so I'm going to start today by talking about a few pieces which are major, supposedly supporting the idea that the earth is actually younger than 6,000 years old, according to that theory. And so what I found is that there are two key elements of this theory that I'm going to discuss today. And they're based upon two animals that are named in the Bible, and they are called Leviathan and Behemoth. And so let's go over to Job 41. Job chapter 41. Among all of the creatures that are mentioned in the scriptures, many have wondered about these two animals called Leviathan and Behemoth. Now, young earth creationists believe that Leviathan, as described in chapter 41 of Job and a few other places in the Bible, that this is speaking of a prehistoric serpent-like creature that's a mythical in type, kind of like the creature supposedly that dwells or dwelt in Loch Ness. And there are many who actually support the idea that Leviathan is likened to a fire-breathing dragon, and that it actually, that this chapter actually adds truth to the fables of old. They also claim that the Bible's description of Behemoth in the previous chapter of Job, which we will go through later, but they claim that this describes a genus of dinosaur called a sauropod, and they claim that this dinosaur actually existed at the same time as early man, and they even assert that it likely existed up into the Middle Ages. And then they therefore assert that these two animals validates their young earth theory. Could this be true? What are Leviathan and Behemoth? Well, I'd like to preface this message with the fact that it's a difficult question to answer. And it must be understood that nobody can know for certain what these two physical creatures are. And so all attempts to explain Leviathan are speculation. Nevertheless, the scriptures do contain clues that help us to understand that these animals or beings, they are not legendary serpents, they are not mythical dragons, they're not prehistoric dinosaurs. And to begin, let's consider God's description of Leviathan in the book of Job, and we're going to read the first 10 verses of chapter 41. Here we have God talking to Job about how he should be a humble man and not proud and think he is something great. And he starts to speak of some of the other things that God had created. In verse 1, can you draw out Leviathan with a hook, or snare its tongue with a line which you lower? Can you put a reed through his nose, or pierce his jaw with a hook? Will he make many supplications to you? Will he speak softly to you? Will he make a covenant with you? Will you take him as a servant forever? Will you play with him as with a bird, or will you leash him for your maidens, kind of like a pet? Will your companions make a banquet of him? Speaking of a meal, will they apportion or cut him up and sell him among the merchants? Can you fill his skin with harpoons or his head with fishing spears? Lay your hand on him. Remember the battle. Never do it again. Indeed, any hope of overcoming him is false. Shall one not be overwhelmed at the sight of him? No one is so fierce that he would dare stir him up. And who then is able to stand against me? So we hear this conversation taking place, that God is making a comparison between the strength of a man, between the might of Leviathan, and also the power of God. And so we see the references here make it clear that a single man using, you know, primitive tools that would have existed during Job's time, that he would be unable to overcome this creature. And the terms describe futile attempts that might be made using hooks, harpoons, or leash, or fishing spears. Of course, there's no mention of modern equipment that we might have today. None of this existed. We have fleets of shipping vessels, and we have, you know, the invention of gunpowder and rockets and all kinds of weapons that could easily destroy pretty much any being physical being that exists on the planet. But that wasn't the case during Job's time. Nonetheless, Leviathan appears to be an aquatic creature and nearly impossible to subdue, if at all, and at least using only primitive tools. And God indicated that no person in their right mind would initiate a battle or an encounter with Leviathan. If you have a ribbon or a marker, let's go ahead and put that here in Job 41, because we're going to come back. But I want to turn over several pages to Psalm 104, where there is another description or a mention of Leviathan. So obviously God was describing a powerful creature or being that's difficult, near to impossible to conquer using spears or harpoons or hooks. Futile attempts, as I had said already. But there's another set of verses that also describe Leviathan here in Psalm 104 in verses 25 through 26. And it indicates a sea creature. Where the psalmist said, "This great and wide sea, in which are innumerable teeming things, living things, both small and great, there are ships that sail about, and there is that Leviathan which you have made to play there." So here we see that the psalmist is speaking of a creature that plays in the sea or in a large body of water that God made, and it's referred to as Leviathan. So apparently it could be found in oceans or sea, perhaps even large lakes. It's clear that this creature, or creatures, I should say, existed during the time of Job. They existed during the time of this author here, King David. But does such an animal exist today? And what could it be? But again, it's a difficult question to answer, considering we don't know exactly what it could have been. But there are several explanations, and none of them relate to a fire-breathing dragon or a dinosaur. And so let's go back a few pages to Psalm 74. Psalm chapter 74. Before discussing what Leviathan might be, I want us to consider that this creature called Leviathan has been personified in the scriptures. So notice the following verses in Psalm 74, which they seem, as a topical reading, a natural reading, would seem to indicate that God struck many of these beasts down and actually gave them as food for people to eat. In Psalm 74, in verses 12 through 14, "God is my king from old, working salvation in the midst of the earth." And then it gives an example here. "You divided the sea by your strength. You broke the heads of the sea serpents in the waters. You broke the heads of Leviathan in pieces and gave him as food to the people inhabiting the wilderness." So this psalm, it considers works of God and what he is capable of. It gives a few examples if you read through the whole psalm, but I'm just going to talk about this part specifically. But it speaks of him saving a people in the midst of the earth, and this is talking about the Israelites in the midst of the land of Egypt. It talks about dividing the sea, which we know God did in the Red Sea. It talks about how he broke the heads of sea serpents and also heads of Leviathan and gave them as food to people in the wilderness. Now, if we were to attempt to define Leviathan as some kind of dinosaur or perhaps a shark or a crocodile, something of that nature, and using this psalm, well, we'd run into a problem because all of those animals would be unclean for food, and God would not give those animals to his people to eat, never to eat unclean animals, Leviticus 11. You don't have to turn there, but that's just a reference to that. The law of the unclean and clean. So it is possible, of course, that there were literal serpents or beasts known as Leviathan that lived in the Red Sea that were killed collaterally when these walls of water came crashing down and killed Pharaoh and his army. And so if such beasts were killed and washed ashore, well, they could have been used for food of pagan tribes, not by God's people, but of pagan tribes that inhabited the wilderness, because it says they were food for the inhabitants of the wilderness. However, it must be understood at this point that some of these verses are symbolic. The reference to a people being saved, it's literal. The sea being divided, literal. Descriptions of Israel's salvation during the Exodus, of course, literal. At that time, they were pursued by Pharaoh's army, a massive army, fortified army, strong, and something to be fearful of if you are not backed by God. But I believe that this pagan military force found in Pharaoh and his army is described here, poetically, as a band of sea serpents whose heads were crushed when 500-foot walls of water came crashing down upon them. And so these beasts, described as serpents and leviathans, are personified as Pharaoh and his wicked army. And the poetry illustrates what happened when God took out the army in one fell swoop. Exodus 14 and verse 30 is a good scripture to have. And your side note here tells about how the aftermath of the Red Sea coming back down, folding in on that army, it left thousands of bodies scattered across the shoreline of the Red Sea. And these carcasses of the Egyptians, they would have become food, but not for God's people, and not even for a people in the wilderness, lest they were cannibals. So the broken bodies would become food for what? Coyotes, jackals, vultures, other birds of prey or cleanup crew. And these are animals that would have already inhabited the wilderness, inhabitants of the wilderness, as it says. Now, interestingly, the complete Jewish Bible translates Psalm 74:14 in this way, where it says that you smashed sea monsters' heads, you crushed the heads of Leviathan, and gave it as food to the creatures of the desert. So it's a possibility. I'm not saying that's exactly what how it should be translated, but I'm just saying it is a possibility that the food of these serpents or personified army of Pharaoh was given to creatures that inhabited the wilderness. One thing is certain, that Leviathan was considered a dreadful creature of great strength that nobody should want to disturb, and that's also pointed out in Job 3 and verse 8. And so it's fitting that Pharaoh and his army would be personified in this way, because they were a force to be reckoned with, seemingly undefeatable force, the strongest army in the world at that time. But they were destroyed in a sea, the same dwelling place as Leviathan. But this isn't the only scripture to turn to, because interestingly, there's a striking parallel between Pharaoh and Satan. The Pharaoh of the Exodus and Satan, and we're familiar with this concept. Pharaoh was a type of devil attempting to destroy God's people while they sought a promised land. And the promised land pictures the coming kingdom of God to this earth that we as Christians seek while being pursued by the devil in this world, which is a virtual wilderness of sin. Like Leviathan was crushed, so Satan and his angels will be destroyed. And this leads to another personification of this creature, Isaiah 27. Isaiah in chapter 27. The prophet Isaiah wrote about the end of the age. He wrote about how the devil will be punished for 1,000 years and how he will ultimately be destroyed. And notice how God inspired the use of the expression or term Leviathan when describing Satan's punishment and his death. In verse 1, that is, of Isaiah 27, it says, "In that day, the Eternal with his sore and great and strong sword shall punish Leviathan, the piercing serpent, even Leviathan, that crooked serpent, and he shall slay the dragon," or reptile, depending on your translation, "the dragon that is in the sea." So it says that God himself will punish Leviathan in verse 1 of Isaiah 27. And it's also calling him a piercing serpent and a dragon. Now, I'm going to rattle off a few scriptures here that I think are good ones to have in your side notes for Isaiah 27 and verse 1. Verses that use similar terms when describing the devil. Genesis 3 and verse 1 says that the serpent was more cunning than any beast of the field which God had made, and obviously referring to Satan, who deceived Eve and at the same time was led to the deception of Adam. in Ephesians 6 and verse 16. It says that we should take the shield of faith and quench all the fiery darts of the wicked one. What are the fiery darts? Well, that's spiritual darts that Satan throws at us, who is, as Isaiah 27:1 says, a piercing serpent. In Revelation 12 and verse 9, it says that Satan is that great dragon that was cast out, that serpent of old called the devil and Satan, and explains how he deceives the whole world. In Revelation 13, verses 1 and 2, as John saw a beast rising up out of the sea, calling it the dragon that gave the beast his power. In Revelation 20 and verse 2, it says that it explains how a mighty angel instructed by God will come and lay hold of the dragon, that serpent of old who is the devil and Satan, and will bind him for 1,000 years. So Isaiah, in verse 1 of chapter 27, was not speaking of an aquatic beast, not speaking of a reptile that God is going to come down and literally punish with a sword. The terms that this great prophet used were symbolic. Symbolic of Satan's sentence being punished, as it says first in the prophecy of Isaiah, his sentence for 1,000 years in the bottomless pit, and ultimately his death being slain by God. And that slaying will not take place with a literal sword, but it'll take place in the lake of fire, a massive lake of fire, Revelation 20 and verses 1 through 10. So I think this is helpful to us when we try to attempt and define what Leviathan is according to Job in chapter 41. And let's go ahead and go back there now, Job 41. While describing Leviathan to Job, God takes the description even further. And if you think about it, some of the description of this creature or beast or being are quite fantastic if it was just a physical creature alone. So there's a reason I wanted to talk a bit about the personification first, because we see how this chapter moves from talking about a physical creature to a creature that is far more dreadful than anything in the world's oceans. In fact, it says in verse 9, indeed any hope of overcoming him is false. But we have dominion over the animals. We have the ability to overcome any animal, don't we, on the planet? God gave us that ability through a superior mind, where we can create and design and capture and do what we would at times with animals. Even, you know, much, sometimes it's not appropriate what people do with them. But in any case, continuing in the description, let's read verses 12 through 34. God says, I will not conceal his limbs, his mighty power, or his graceful portions. In other words, he said, it's not going to stop talking about it. I have more to say about this subject. Who can remove his outer coat? Who can approach him with a double bride? Who can open the doors of his face with his terrible teeth all around? His rows of scales are his pride, shut up tightly as with a seal. One is so near another that no air can come between them. They are joined one to another. They stick together. They cannot be parted. And this is where some believe, the next section is where some believe that it's referring to a dragon, the fire-breathing dragon. His sneezings flash forth light. His eyes are like the eyelids of the morning. In other words, like a sunrise. Out of his mouth goes burning light, sparks of fire shoot out, smoke goes out of his nostrils as from boiling pot and burning rushes. His breath kindles coals, and a flame goes out of his mouth. Strength dwells in his neck, and sorrow dances before him. In other words, a lot of trouble before him. The folds of his flesh are joined together, they're firm on him and cannot be moved. His heart is as hard as stone, even as hard as the lower millstone. When he raises himself up, the mighty are afraid. Because of his crashings, they are beside themselves. And though the sword reaches him, it cannot avail, nor does spear, dart, or javelin. He regards iron as straw and bronze as rotten wood. The arrow cannot make him flee. Sling stones become like stubble to him. Darts are regarded as straw. He laughs at the threat of javelins. His undersides are like sharp potsherds. He spreads pointed marks in the mire, and he makes the deep boil like a pot. He makes the sea like a pot of ointment. He leaves a shining wake behind him, and one would think the deep had white hair because of the boiling, the foam. On earth there is nothing like him, which is made without fear. He beholds every high thing. He is king over all the children of pride. Now, when we consider the personification that I had discussed earlier in other verses, and what would otherwise be quite fantastic descriptions of what some believe is a creature that that roamed the earth during the time of early man, we begin to believe to see that the creature being described here in Job 41, it's more than just a physical being. And there is quite a bit of evidence to support that. I believe that this is comparing, in much of the case, a spirit being that is likened to a dreadful beast known as Leviathan in some ways. And even the first portion here of this chapter, if we go a little bit of review here, the first portion of this chapter seems to be pointing to something beyond the physical realm at times. It looks as though God is being masterfully poetic here, and he's using symbolic terms at times to describe the devil and also comparing him to a creature that had some similar characteristics. Look at verses 3 and 4 of this. Will he make many supplications to you? Will he speak softly to you? What kind of creature would ever try to make supplications to a human being? None. Will he make a covenant with you? Will you take him as a servant forever? Well, we're given dominion over the animals. We can subdue all of them if we want to. If, you know, we do have the ability, not with our own arm, but with the mind, we can create tools to do this. So, I understand it could be speaking symbolically of a creature as well. In verse 6, will your companions make a banquet of him? Will they apportion him among the merchants? In other words, chop him up, use him to sell. Well, we have done that with just about every creature that has existed. We've found some way to market them, to use whether it's the skin or some kind of secretion they have, or the glands, or even little beetles we find uses for in certain products. And, you know, we don't use much of those products, of course, but the point is he saying, you think you're going to do this with a physical animal, or is it speaking of something else, perhaps a spirit being? There's no way you can make a merchant of Satan or his demons, or cut him up and sell him to people. In verse 9 of the same chapter, indeed any hope of overcoming him is false. Well, we have dominion over the animal kingdom. It's Genesis 1:26, Psalm 8:6. So it says how God put us having dominion over the physical animals that he had created. In verses 18 through 21, his sneezings flash forth light, his eyes are like eyelids of the morning. Out of his mouth goes burning light, sparks of fire shoot out, smoke goes out of his nostrils, a breath kindles coals, and a flame goes out of his mouth. Could this really be a creature, a fire-breathing dragon, a mythical creature that comes from the fables of old? Or is it describing some of the attributes of something much more dreadful and terrible, being the devil? Verse 24, his heart is as hard as stone, even as hard as the lower millstone. There is not a creature on the earth that has the heart as hard as a stone. Of course, it could be speaking symbolically. Like, it's you can't penetrate it. His stubbornness is what it could be talking about. His pride makes his heart hard. No remorse. Unsympathetic, in other words. Verses 26 through 29, if the sword reaches him, it cannot avail, neither spear nor dart or javelin. He regards iron as straw and bronze as rotten wood. Is there any creature that has ever existed that can, you know, crush a bar of iron like it's just a piece of straw? It's debatable. And my point is today not to give us all of the answers. I'm not saying I have the answer exactly, but I'm saying there are possibilities, other possibilities, that are not a dinosaur or a fire-breathing dragon. Verse 31, he makes the deep boil like a pot. He makes the sea like a pot of ointment. And I'm going to look at Ezekiel 32 in just a moment. In verse 33, on the earth there is nothing like him which is made without fear. Well, this seems to be pointing to something that was not created on the earth, but exists on the earth, which wicked angels and the devil were created, not on the earth, but they exist on the earth. Now, another interesting and possibly parallel scripture is Ezekiel 32. Ezekiel 32 in verse 2, where it says that the Son of Man, it's speaking of another wicked leader of Egypt being Pharaoh. It's not the Pharaoh of the Exodus, but it's a Pharaoh of Egypt. And God said, Son of Man, take up a lamentation for Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and say to him, you are like a young lion among the nations, and you are like a monster in the seas, bursting forth in your rivers, troubling the waters with your feet and fouling their rivers. Sounds much like verse 31 of Job 41, where he makes the sea like a pot of ointment. And so it's possible there's just symbolism going on here, a personification of Leviathan. And then in the final descriptive terms here of Leviathan in verses 33 and 34, verse 34, it says that he beholds every high thing. He is king over all the children of pride. So this final descriptive term, I think, is central to understanding the personification of Leviathan, because pride is never considered a positive attribute in the scriptures, ever. Romans 1:30 puts the proudful or pride in the same category as inventors of evil things, as disobedient people, as haters of God. So who then is the king of the proud? Is it a dinosaur? A dragon? A fire-breathing dragon? An animal? No, the king of the proud is the current king of this world, the devil. He's the king of the proud. Psalm in chapter 8, if you go over a few pages, the next book over, Psalm chapter 8. There is a hierarchy designed by God, spoken of by King David in Psalm 8. It's mentioned other places in the scriptures, but I think this is a good one to turn to regarding the king of the children of pride. Psalm chapter 8 and verses 3 through 8. The Psalm of David says, when I consider your heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon and stars which you have ordained, what is man that you are mindful of him, and the son of man that you visit him? Well, you have made him a little lower than the angels. You've crowned him with glory and honor. You've made him to have dominion over the works of your hands, and you have put all things under his feet. And then it starts to name things under our control, all sheep, oxen, beasts of the field, birds of the air, fish of the sea, that passes through the pass of the sea. So we see here that God designed the physical creation with a hierarchy. He made us a little lower than spirit beings, being angels, and he gave us dominion over the animal kingdom. And so we have the ability, actually, to subdue every beast that we might want to, whether it's in the mountains or in the plains or in the sea. But we cannot subdue Leviathan when it's personified as the devil. We cannot subdue demons. We cannot subdue any righteous angel that God has created. And we see that Satan, we know, he is the chief of wicked angels, and he's not allowed himself to be in subjection to anyone except for, well, you know, he's subject to God. He's on a leash, if you will. God only lets him go so far. You know, he has boundaries that he cannot cross. But even the angel of the eternal said to Satan in Zechariah in verse 3 chapter 3 and in verse 2, this angel of God said that the eternal rebuke you, Satan. And Jude 9 relates that the archangel Michael did not even dare to bring a reviling accusation against the devil. He understood that he had a position of authority that God had given him. And even though he contended with the devil in Daniel 10, he didn't bring a railing or reviling accusation against him. So the hierarchy is God, angels, humans, and animals. And so the king of the proud cannot be God. It's not a righteous angel, and it's also not an animal. It can only be a personification of the devil. So we see that Leviathan symbolically is Satan at times. But what could a physical form of Leviathan be? Well, there's a few examples of what it could be that I will relate to you. And I'm not saying that that is the case, but I'm just, again, introducing the possibility that there are some sharks that are found in the world's oceans that are 30 to 40 feet in length and weigh more than 20 tons. There are other sharks that are much smaller, but they are still very vicious or daunting to most people. But these animals have a very thick skin, which can be penetrated, but it does take a number of spears or just the right weapon in order to kill them. And so the primitive type of hooks or harpoons or fishing spears that may have been available during Job's time would be vastly ineffective when trying to subdue a 40-foot shark. So it's possible, anyway, that God and the psalmist were describing a powerful species of shark. Another explanation could be a giant squid. Now, obviously, the flesh of this animal is very soft, but it's when a squid of this size and magnitude moves so fast that you cannot, in fact, they've still been unable to catch one, and very few have been able to even get a glimpse of one on video footage. If you try to find it on the internet, I found a few that have just a quick glimpse of a giant squid because they move so fast, and so it makes them nearly impossible to kill or capture. But there have been carcasses of these impressive creatures that have washed ashore throughout various parts of the world. The largest documented one that we have a carcass of is 59 feet long. Imagine a squid of that size, 59 feet. In any case, since the 13th century, there have been sea merchants claiming that their boat or their ship was groped or attacked by a monstrous beast of the ocean, which many believe was probably a giant squid. Another possible candidate for Leviathan is the crocodile. And I know many crocodiles are freshwater, or most are freshwater animals that live in rivers or ponds. But there are some that do live in salty swamps and also in a brackish coastal waters. In addition, it's interesting to consider that the term lake is not found in the Old Testament scriptures. And the expression sea is sometimes used when describing a large body of water that is actually a lake. An example is the Sea of Galilee. It's actually a freshwater lake. And so could it be that when it says sea, referring to Leviathan at times, that it also might include a large freshwater bodies of water? Now, crocodiles, they do have some of the descriptive terms of Leviathan with thick, you know, armor, a skin that's tightly knit, teeth that are all lined up, rowed together. And some are reach 20 feet long, or they can reach up to 20 feet long and larger, weighing well over 2,000 pounds. And while a relative few of these animals have been subdued for entertainment purposes, crocodiles are extremely dangerous. Nobody in their right mind would go face an encounter with a crocodile in the wild, and the only way you could subdue them safely is by using modern equipment, which would not have been available during Job's time. But there is another possibility when it comes to a physical creature of Leviathan. Because we know that this creature, the scriptures show us that It is used symbolically to represent Satan at times. And so, is it possible that Leviathan is more of a general term to describe a number of beasts that are daunting or impressive that could be found in the seas and the oceans and the lakes? Now, think about this for the moment. We don't see the expression shark, squid, crocodile, alligator, or some of these other descriptions. We don't see those terms used in the scriptures. We know they existed at that time. Of course they did. But the terms are not used. So could it be that Leviathan is a general term that might be describing a number of these beasts that were just quite, you know, frightening at times to experience, that people would know, you know, it's really not a good idea to try to go after, to kill or capture these things? It's a possibility. And so as stated at the beginning of this message, it's difficult to know exactly what the physical creature of Leviathan was. There is, of course, a last possibility that Leviathan was actually something that is now extinct. That is entirely possible. But the chances of it being an actual fire-breathing dragon or a dinosaur that existed during the time of early man, I think, are slim to none. Now let's look at Job 40 for a moment. Job in chapter 40. Because there is another creature used by young earth creationists as supposed evidence that dinosaurs, prehistoric dinosaurs, the bones that we see in museums around the world, that these creatures are younger than 6,000 years old. And it's also found in the book of Job. It's an animal that's called Behemoth. What was this great and mighty beast called Behemoth? Well, as I had stated at the beginning of the message, some claim it was a sauropod. And I know we've all seen a picture or drawing of a sauropod. There's actually various species of sauropod, but it's a dinosaur that weighed more than 46 tons when it was an adult, and it was 85 feet long from head to tail. So we know those animals did exist at one time. We have evidence that they existed. But did they exist during the time of Job, during the time of Adam or Eve, or up into the Middle Ages? Job 40 and verse 15 through 24, I'm just going to read through the entire description here, where God said, "Now look at the behemoth which I made along with you. He eats grass like an ox. See now, his strength is in his hips and his power is in his stomach muscles. He moves his tail like a cedar. The sinews of his thighs are tightly knit. His bones are like beams of bronze, his ribs like bars of iron. He is the first of the ways of God. Only he who made him can bring near his sword. Surely the mountains yield food for him, and all the beasts of the field play there. He lies under the lotus trees in a covert of reeds and marsh. The lotus trees cover him with their shade, and the willows by the brook surround him. Indeed, the river may rage, yet he is not disturbed. He is confident, though the Jordan gushes into his mouth, though he takes it in his eyes, or one pierces his nose with a snare." So apparently this animal could be pierced. He could be brought near to. Still an impressive beast, and there is some symbolism involved in the description here, but it doesn't appear that there is a personification of this creature called Behemoth. Interestingly, the term Behemoth is a plural term. It actually comes from an Egyptian word. It refers to more than one of its kind. And God said that Behemoth was made along with you. And so he's speaking to Job, obviously, but he's referring to Job as a man or a human being. And we understand that animals were made during the same time as humans, not on the same day, but during the same period of the recreation there. But we also know angels were created long before humans existed. And so what God described here is a beast that was created at the same time as man. And it's possible this beast still exists today. Now consider some of the characteristics. I'm just going to briefly rattle them off that we had just read, that it eats grass, it eats and other vegetation. It says its food can even come from the mountains for this creature. It's impressive in its strengths, and it refers to a lot of strength being in the hips or the abdominal area. It says that its tail moves like a cedar, which is a species of tree. It says that the tendons of its testicles, or its stones, if you have the translation, might say stones, that they're tightly knit, being in the abdominal area. Its bones are extremely strong. It compares its bones to metal here, and I think that's somewhat symbolic. It can be found among trees and near brooks and rivers. It's quite comfortable in a large body of flowing water, it seems. And it's considered chief in size and strength, or at least first in order. So the fact that Behemoth was an herbivore could point to any number of strong animals. But when we compare it with other descriptive terms that I had mentioned, the list gets narrowed. It says that the strength of this animal is centered on the hips and the abdominal area. Now, the young earth creationists believe that this must refer to a dinosaur that when it walked back and forth, its hips, that its enormous tail would sway back and forth. It'd be kind of like if that was a full-grown cedar tree, it'd be like a cedar tree in hurricane force winds, because trees don't really move like that unless it's something extremely daunting. But in any case, an animal of such size would have great hips in its strength and abdominal area, but it also has great strength in other parts of his body as well. But the weight of the idea that the behemoth is a dinosaur bears on this these words where it says that he moves his tail like a cedar. And so the description points to a species of tree, a cedar tree, very familiar to us. But the cedar has many subspecies as well. And how large it needs to be in order for its tail to be like a cedar is not entirely known. Now, it's assumed by young earth creationists that the reference must be talking about a large, full-grown cedar tree that has, you know, a trunk that might be, you know, 8 or 10 feet around in circumference. But let's examine the cedar tree for a moment, because the cedar is a conifer. It comes in many shapes and sizes. And, for example, there's the Atlas cedar of Morocco. There is the Cypress cedar. There is the Diodor cedar that's found in the Himalayas. There's the Lebanon cedar, the Turkish cedar. There's the North American cedar, which actually is known by various names, such as a Virginia juniper or the red juniper or the aromatic cedar, which all of us, I know many of us anyway, like the smell of cedar. Sometimes you can buy bags of cedar chips and put it in your drawer and open your drawer to get your clothes and it smells nice. In any case, there are a large number of varieties of this tree. And some of them are straight up, like the evergreen. There are some that do grow straight up. But many of them, more than half of them, actually grow much like a maple tree or an oak tree, where they kind of grow, they have a trunk, yes, but they kind of grow out. It's more of an oval or a rounded type of tree. Now, the only movement we see in trees such as this are very gentle sways in the wind, isn't it? I mean, we don't see large trunks of tree blowings over like this unless it's one of the hurricanes or a tornado that somebody might experience. But overall, there's not much movement in these trees. Nonetheless, simply because the tail of this animal is likened to a cedar tree does not mean that the tail has to be dozens of feet long and that it must have the circumference as a full-grown trunk of a cedar tree. It simply means that it needs to be tree-like, like the cedar, some part of the cedar tree. And with this in mind, there are three animals that have tails that look much like either a young tree or the bark-covered branch of a tree. They're rough, they are strong, and there's very little movement in their tails much of the time, just like the branches of a tree. They have very little movement much of the time. In addition to this, when mentioning these three animals, which are the hippopotamus, the rhinoceros, and the elephant, and you've probably heard this before, but the hippopotamus tail is only small when relatively speaking. It actually is somewhere between 13 and 20 inches long. It's really not short. It's only small when you compare it to the tail of a smaller animal, like a rodent or perhaps a bird. And here is a not such a pleasant picture, but we'll see. I'll pass these around after. You come over here, honey. And I'll give them to you when I'm done. You can kind of pass them around. This is a hippopotamus tail. It's pretty stubby. It's stump-like. And it looks pretty small. It looks like we could probably hold it in our hand, and I guess you probably could. But when you consider it's about 20 inches long, it's much bigger than we might think. But it's pretty rough. It looks much like the branch of a tree, doesn't it? It'll kind of like the texture of a tree. Go ahead and pass it around. This is a rhinoceros tail. And this rhinoceros, which, although they don't move their tails a whole lot, this particular one is pretty excited. And he's got his tail sticking up. Probably looking at the camera, but it does kind of look like a branch sticking up like that. And let's look at a closer-up version of this tail right here. Same animal. This is a rhinoceros tail. That is obviously the back end. But it looks a lot like look at the texture. I don't know if you can see that on the camera, but the texture of this tail is quite rough, kind of like the bark or branch of a tree. And here's an even closer-up version. Thank you. This one is pretty close. But look at the texture of that thing. I mean, it's not your average puppy tail, is it? So could it be that this is a tail likened to some part of a tree? And then I think, the rhinoceros tail is much larger than a hippopotamus tail. A rhinoceros have tail that is actually up to 2 feet long. So think about that when you're looking at those pictures. That tail's like 2 feet long. That's not small. And, of course, it's much larger at the base as far as the circumference goes. Now, an elephant's tail is quite the same texture, but is much larger. It's anywhere from 3 to 5 feet long. And here is an elephant walking with its tail hanging down, which I think resembles the branch of a tree. Even if you turned it upside down, let's look at that. Looks kind of like a tree standing up there, doesn't it? A little young tree, but a small one, but tree nonetheless. Here's another picture of the elephant tail, kind of swaying a little bit there as it's walking, much like the young earth creationists say that the sauropod's tail swayed as it walked. And again, it's only theory that the sauropod's tail moved in this way. It probably did, but we've never seen one. We're just going on the evidence of the way the bone structure of these animals were. Here's another elephant tail hanging down. If that doesn't look like a branch of a tree, I don't know what does. In any case, any one of these tails could be compared to the attributes of a cedar. It doesn't have to be a dinosaur tail in order to fit the description. One of the other descriptions are that the animal has intra-abdominal testicles or stones, and it's believed that dinosaurs were built or designed in this way. They had their testicles inside of the abdominal cavity, such is the case with reptiles today, and that's why we believe that that was the case with them. Again, we don't have any examples to know for sure, but this is also the case with the elephant and the rhinoceros, and the hippopotamus. It says that the creature had very strong bones that is symbolically compared to metal, brass, or iron. Well, obviously, dinosaur bones were very strong in this way. We know that, at least the large dinosaurs, there were different sizes of them. The sauropod definitely would have had very large and strong bones. But comparatively speaking, so are the bones of the hippopotamus. So are the bones of the rhinoceros and the elephant. When compared to our bones, they are like iron compared to ours, which might break a lot more easily. And so the statement that God made to Job is true in this case and in the other. So God indicates that behemoth could be found among trees, near brooks and rivers. Now, we cannot know for certain what kind of habitat the sauropods preferred. It's only a guess. In fact, it's just a guess that they were herbivores. We don't know for certain. But it's a good guess, I believe, but it's something we don't entirely know. But we do know that the elephant and the rhinoceros, the hippopotamus, that these are herbivores, that they prefer to eat all kinds of vegetation, whether in the field or the plain or the mountains. And we do know also that these animals love water. They're not afraid to dive into rivers that are flowing very strong. They love it. It's like their natural habitat. Now, one of the other descriptions of behemoth says that it's chief among the creation. Now, certainly, these animals are much stronger than human beings, aren't they? Elephants, hippopotamus, rhinoceros. In fact, do you know what the number one killer of people is in Africa? I think we all know that. Hippopotamus is the number one killer of people in Africa. I heard a comedian make a joke about that. I won't repeat it because it's not really funny. It's a little funny, but anyway. Sauropods obviously would have been some of the largest creatures that God had made, at least on the land. So comparatively speaking, obviously the sauropods were the chief among the dinosaurs. But were they chief among men? That's another question. So the elephant, the rhinoceros, and such, they are chief when it comes to physical strength, that is, among the land animals. So I think the point that God was trying to make to Job and that he is trying to make to us is that he's relating his power and his strength as compared to the creation. And that those animals that are very impressive to us, that are very strong, that compared to him, they're like nothing. In fact, he made them. So he is obviously much more powerful than anything that God has made. And so while there is a measure of speculation involved on both sides of the argument, I think the behemoth closely resembles an elephant, possibly a rhinoceros. All of these have, they had same habitat, eat vegetation, intra-abdominal testicles, very strong bones, the largest, most powerful of land animals, and they actually were created before Adam and Eve first. In other words, they were created on the fifth day. Well, human beings were created on the sixth day. And, of course, they can be found frequently bathing in large bodies of water. So the point is to assert that behemoth must be a dinosaur that existed during the time of Job, it's purely speculation, and it disregards these at least three other species here. But of course, there is another possibility that behemoth is something that no longer exists, that it actually became extinct at some point. It's estimated that over 300 species, I think it's 370-something species, I'm not sure the exact number, but over 300 species of birds, mammals, fish, what have you, that they have all gone extinct in the last 500 years due to human activity. Those numbers might be much higher if we had zoological data that dated back thousands of years. We just don't have the information, so we do not know exactly. Do we have every creature that God made today? No, we do not. We obviously don't have any of the dinosaurs. Not a single one exists. We don't have any of the 300 that's on the list that have gone extinct. But it doesn't mean that dinosaurs were created at the same time as Adam and Eve. And while this issue as to whether the earth is hundreds of thousands or millions of years old or maybe less than 6,000 years old, it's not a matter of salvation. But I think it is an important issue for true Christians. And the reason is this, because God has designed a plan for mankind. And that plan includes creating angels long before he created mankind. Now, the angels that sinned were not persuaded by God to sin. No, but he gave them free moral agency. He gave them the ability to choose, much as like he gave us the ability to choose. And their gift of being a free moral agent, it is actually helping us in a way, isn't it? It's helping God to create a people, to choose a people that will have resolve to resist evil and to resist temptations to sin. And so the destiny of those individuals who will be chosen is actually related to Lucifer's fall from grace. And this fall, the scriptures indicate, took place long before man was created. And we'll talk about that in another message. But if we begin to believe that the earth is less than 6,000 years old, and the entire universe came into an existence in a 24-hour period on the first day of the recreation, as stated in Genesis 1, well, we have to begin rationalizing away massive amounts of scientific data when science actually does not contradict the Bible. True science actually conforms to the scriptures if it's rightly interpreted and rightly applied. And so we might accuse atheists of creating theories like the nebular hypothesis or evolution in an attempt to discredit the Bible. Such people, we see, they wrest the scientific data, true data, and they attempt to justify their theories by taking the data out of its context. And so they'll misapply the truth so that it will fit their theory. But would we be any better if we promoted unfounded theories of a young earth in order to discount evolution? Because that is what young earth creationism does. It attempts to take science out of its context and apply it to their own theory. And there are other claims that young earth creationism makes that I'm going to discuss in another message, you know, such as radiocarbon dating and the fossilization and geological strata and what have you. But my point is we don't have to make assumptions regarding the scriptures in order to arrive at a conclusion that the Bible is true. We actually don't have to redefine scientific data or evidence either, because true science perfectly fits with the scriptures because God created it. He created science. He actually is the one that gave us the data if we rightly interpret it and rightly imply it. So it's entirely possible, and there is biblical evidence, that dinosaurs existed long before man and that the earth is in fact very old. And this truth does not give credit to evolution at all. But we're going to hear more about that in the next sermon regarding the theory of young earth creationism.